Lean Leadership Podcast, episode 56.
This is the Lean Leadership Podcast. Equip yourself with the tools for success in your team's lean journey by learning from the world's top lean professionals. Listen at the risk of improving with your host, Chris Burnham.
Today's guest is Matt Wyatt. In every episode, I ask our guests to share with us a favorite quote or mantra from a leader and why they chose that quote. In episode 44, Jamie Parker shared a quote from our guest today. I reached out to Matt and asked him to be a guest on the podcast, and I'm glad that he accepted. Matt is the founding partner at Chapman & Company Leadership Institute, whose parent company is Barry Waymiller. Barry Waymiller is well known for combining people-centric and lean thinking. In his role at Chapman & Company, Matt draws on over 20 years of leadership experience as a former military officer, helping organizations create cultures that put people and business in harmony. Chapman & Company believes that culture drives organizational outcomes. In other words, culture doesn't eat strategy for breakfast, it feeds at breakfast and every other meal. They help build an organization and/or team culture intentionally to deliver deliberate outcomes. Here's our guest, Matt Wyatt. Matt, we briefly touched on who you were in the intro, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how leadership and continuous improvement is a part of your life?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Chris. I really appreciate you having me on the podcast today. I'm originally from Orange County, California. I did a spectacular job at getting really bad grades in high school. And so I joined the military at a pretty early age, got my degree and made a career out of it. So I spent about 24 years in the U.S. Air Force. But a lot of that time was spent working with foreign militaries and different kind of organizations. And I've since left the military and started a consultancy called Chapman & Co. Leadership Institute. It's under the parent company, Barry Waymiller, headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri. And I do this type of leadership consulting and sometimes on lean and continuous improvement. So it's kind of a professional and a personal kind of quest on this.
Well, Matt, I appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Before we get started in the interview, we always ask our guests to share with us a favorite quote or a mantra. Can you share with us what your quote is and why you chose it?
We just jump right into the heavy stuff, don't we? Probably the one, and this is not necessarily mine. I guess I'm a logical person. And so I see the logic in this really strongly. And there's a human element to it. Inc. magazine was doing this survey of X amount of people. And they were trying to ask them, what's the one leadership maxim that you would say encompasses all of what great leadership is about? And this one's by Teddy Roosevelt, where he said, no one cares how much you know until they know how much that you care. I think that's probably one of my favorite ones that I see used often. The one that I love that seems to resonate a lot with people, especially in leadership or continuous improvement circles, was they were doing an interview with Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa. And they talked to him and they said, can you tell us about the elections that you lost? And he says, I've never lost an election. And they kind of were pointed to his record, and which he, of course, didn't win everything. And he said, oh, no, I never lose. I only win or I learn. And I think that's a really good one, especially on the topic of today with lean and continuous improvement.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I think that with lean and continuous improvement, that learning is a critical thing. And that if you don't hit your objective, you've changed the dynamic for what you understand about the current condition. So I think that's absolutely critical that you, as you look forward and you develop yourself as a leader. So I'm glad you shared those quotes with us. Matt, one of my goals for this podcast is to help other leaders resonate with your experiences. So can you kind of share with us the story about how or why you chose the profession that you're in right now?
All right, sure. But it involves a monkey. So I used to have a monkey, and I know for some podcast listeners, you're like, you shouldn't own a monkey. Monkeys aren't pets. I know. I was in the United Nations, and I was stationed in Liberia, West Africa. So we were in the capital city just outside Monrovia, and it was during the civil war. This is 2003 and 4. The country's going through a civil war. UN was sent in. Troops were sent in to kind of stop the violence and such, and I was one of the few Americans that were over there. I think it was a really large contingent of UN. There were about eight of us, I think, Americans. And this one day we're coming back from a mission, a patrol, and a little shanty store there with just a few goods and services. A guy pops out and says, hey, U.S. soldiers, three of us. myself, a Marine friend of mine, and an Army friend of mine, and three of us were walking back. And he says, "Hey, U.S. soldiers, you want to buy a monkey?" I was like, "Do I want to buy a monkey? Heck yeah, I want to buy a monkey." And there, my two friends, we'll call them Clint and Jeff, because that's their names. They go, "Wyatt, don't buy this monkey. Do not buy this damn monkey." I'm like, "Oh, we're buying a monkey." So we saw this monkey. Long story short, we bring this monkey back to our compound, the place we're living. The monkey's name is Jack. We didn't name it, just Jack. That's the monkey's name. And all of us are we're a little scared of Jack as well. Jack's on a leash and we're walking Jack back. And when Jack starts running toward us, we drop the leash and run around. The kids all around in the local village, they're highly amused by this. They think it's hysterical. We bring Jack back. And of course, we're the Americans. So we're like, we shouldn't be tying up monkeys. This should be a free range monkey. The monkey should just be out in the yard, running around, having a great time. And Jack really loved it. And he loved us because we fed him whatever he wanted, bananas, got to run, had the whole run of the house and around our compound. When we would leave and run missions for the day, we'd have to leave Jack there. And Jack got bored and he would always jump over our compound wall and then go steal the neighbor's food. He would be recaptured by the neighbors. And so just about every day we would come back to a note. And sometimes the note changed, but the basic note was this: "Dear U.S. soldier, we have Jack. You pay us $50 or we eat Jack." So Jack was like, I don't know how much we spent on Jack, but it was a fortune. The point of this whole story, I'm not even sure why I'm telling you this. The point of this whole story was, this is a little bit like continuous improvement. We never did anything different. We just left on missions and we knew Jack was going to escape. We knew we'd have to go negotiate for his return. We knew it would cost us money. And it almost became like this bonding thing. And we never even said at one point, like, maybe we should help Jack out. Maybe we should figure out a way that we don't have to keep bribing the neighbors and Jack stays safer. So there you go. So the reason I said it was, how do you get into, a lot of times I think, especially in our organizations, we just do the things because the inertia has put it there. We put systems and processes around and we just don't want to deal with breaking it apart and making it a little bit better. So there you go. Jack, you should have had better humans is what I'm saying.
I love that story, Matt. That's the most unique story that I've ever had in the podcast. I didn't realize it.
Stories on your.
I mean, I've never had a soldier, a Marine, and an airman joke involving a monkey at the beginning. But that's solid. But
there you go.
I think there's a metaphor there about chasing the monkey. That just seems like. It's what we get into with work is that we don't solve the problem. We just react to the problem down the line. And, so you have that story. How does that translate to when you come back and now you're transitioning over civilian life? Yeah. How does that get you to where you are right now?
Well, one, I miss Jack. And so I can tell stories about him. I feel connected to him. No, you know, look, I'm on your podcast and I'm not a lean expert. The only black belt I have is what I could buy at Nordstrom's. Like, I'm not a Six Sigma guy. I love the continuous improvement mindset of these things because in my consultancy and when we're working with organizations and to where it's a great place to work and it's also a high performing business, what I find is oftentimes leaders or organizations, we react to the behavior. We react to someone's behavior and we kind of miss the boat on, yeah, but the system that they're in plays a heavy influential role in how they're behaving. I'll give you a short example would be if you walk up to some airlines and you ask the gate agent for some help, and it might seem like you're getting poor customer service. They're pushing you off. They're telling you to go someplace else. Well, the system is set up that way. They literally didn't have the information that you need. They don't have access to how could I change my flight? And so what it looks like is I'm brushing you off. I'm just don't bother me because that's the system they're in. It's frustrating for them as well. And so oftentimes we don't actually tackle the harder work of the systems and structure we're putting people into. We stay right there in the behavior. And then we say things like, well, they need to be more accountable or my employees need to be more engaged. All right, fair. Let's build them a system that allows them to be more engaged and more accountable. So that's how it kind of translates into the work that I do here.
Okay. That makes perfect sense because conversely, I've seen it where people rely just on changing the physical structure in the environment and they don't change the culture or behaviors and you kind of get the same results. I mean, I think You have to figure out a way to integrate the two.
Yeah, both the systems and the behavior. And this is where I think when applied correctly, and whether it's lean or it's any other kind of continuous improvement mindset, I just mean in general, having an eye toward this, any one of the tools, I think works really well. I do see, and this is where I see that these two areas, the behavioral cultural aspect and the systems aspects coming together, is when I use the tools in a more human way. So as an example, I'm not walking up to someone at one of their workstations and saying, well, how could you be more efficient? It implies that they are inefficient. How could you be have less waste? It implies that they're wasteful. I'd much rather ask them a simple question like, what's the most frustrating thing about your job? Let's go after the human element. Because if I fix that, all of the other stuff will be repaired. And then I tend to, in a lean methodology or continuous improvement methodology, we tend to make a big deal about the tools. Like it's almost like you're going to the dentist and they put out that huge tray and it's got all of that suite of metal things. And you're like, do we need all of these for the work you're going to do? Sometimes we don't even have to name it. Like I don't need to say, I am now going to subject you to the five whys exercise. It just becomes the mindset of, hey, if you were going to distill this issue down into one sentence, what would that be? Why do you think that is? And then what drove that? Like you could just get into the mindset of using the tools without actually naming it and making it a huge deal. And that's where I see that it becomes a little more humanistic, if you will.
I love that approach. I'll tell you, my background is I'm probably one of the few individuals that practices lean and continuous improvement that's not of an engineering background. My degree is in criminal justice. Now, I wasn't chasing after a monkey or anything like that in my previous life, but my degree, it taught me skills that, I mean, a criminal justice degree is an applied social sciences degree. So it's, I had to learn how to work with people from varying backgrounds and different socioeconomic diversities and whatnot, and connect to understand, not connect to respond. I think the other thing was it taught me to gather my own set of facts. So I had to learn how to ask really good questions. Right. And so that teaches you how to ask discovery type questions that are open-ended that provoke thought versus a yes or no question. So
sometimes we get caught up in all of that, the nuance of it is people are like, oh, what's the powerful question I can ask? Or reading something by a David Cooper writer for appreciative inquiry or the open-ended. Like if we just distill it down into something very simple, there are three basic type of questions you can ask. Close, and that's any question that could be answered in a yes or no. Leading, which is pretty much like, hey, that podcast was Matt. He was great, wasn't he? That monkey story was funny, right? Like I'm leading you into the answer I want versus the open-ended, like, hey, how was that session? What'd you think? It doesn't have to be that complicated, but that open-ended portion of it, even the degree to where someone starts or what they're going to share is really interesting information. And it's just a much more respectful way of treating another human being. The idea of lean, if I were distilling it down and someone said, what is it? I would say it is a disciplined way to listen to people closest to the work.
Oh, that's a great description of it. I think Cooper Ryder and Whitney, they would not ask us what's wrong here. They would say, what works best here? Using that appreciative inquiry, what do you really like about your job? Like, what do you really enjoy about the work that you're doing? And I'm glad you brought that up because it seems like with continuous improvement that we run around trying to identify the things that are bad and try to make them good. But all you can really do is make them not bad. Like, but you need to find the things that are really good and figure out a way to make them great. And I think there's a nuanced difference between approaching those two different approaches for improvement methodologies in the workplace.
Yeah. And I'm coming back to like the respect and dignity of the individual, regardless of what their role is in an organization. And since we're on the topic of questions, like I'm a consultant. And so if I'm on an airplane and I don't want to talk to someone, it's the surefire way of getting someone who's really chatting with me. They'll sit down next to me in the seat. I know if I don't want to talk to them and I just want to put my headphones on and chill out after a long week of work or whatever it might be, all I have to say is when they say, hey, what do you do for a living? All I have to say is, I'm a consultant. I don't get any like, oh, tell me more. I'd love to hear about your pitch. No, it guarantees I'm eating alone, my friend. So look, I'm a consultant and my job is to get a lot of information in a very efficient way, but in a very caring way about any organization I might be working with. One of my favorite questions is to ask someone at any level in an organization is just to ask them, what's something about your job that very few people know about, but you wish they did? What's something about your job that very few people know about, but you wish that they did? Typically, an answer will fall into two kind of swim lanes, if you will. One is they want you to know the effort they're putting in, how hard it is. The other swim lane, it'll be they want you to know what the impact is. I don't care whether you're in janitorial services or you're a software engineer. Both groups, people want to know that who they are and what they do matter. It's a question that allows them to answer that. And you learn a whole lot about the organization, the culture, how people are treated. It's a good question. It's goldmine. Just giving these away here, folks.
Well, you know, Matt, I know you've had a lot of success in your career with Chapman and Company and being exposed around Barry Waymiller. But there has to be a moment where maybe there was a setback or a learning experience, as we would call it. What's the experience that you've had in your career that you've learned the most from a setback standpoint?
Yeah. Number one, the first one that comes to mind is when someone says, let's go to Tijuana, I think the answer should generally be no.
Just yeah, in general. That's right there with, hey, let's buy a monkey, right? You know, it's
right. Right. I'm with you. You know, I don't know if that is like huge things. The one that I always think it's fun to just go with the first thing that comes to mind. So the first thing I thought was my trips to Tijuana in high school. Then my other ones were probably the ones that come up are when I was in leadership roles and I used different methodology that didn't work out very well. So as an example, email is really great, I think, for sharing like facts, figures, information, those type of things. I think it's really poor way to convey any kind of emotion, especially when that emotion is disappointment, anger, any of those kind of things. And so I can remember, and I'll tell the story, like I've done it twice and I'm 0-for-2 in chewing out large groups of people that I was displeased with. So I was in command. I just thought, look, I'm not happy. I'm going to put all this emotion in there, tell everyone how upset I am. And I'm going to do it from email from an efficiency standpoint. This way, I don't have to call everyone together. I'll just send you a note how upset I am. And then everybody just avoids you for about 2 weeks until they finally gently like, hey, let's just start poking the bear a little bit. Like, are you all right? Are you back? Are you done? And so I think when I think about the failures or setbacks, if you will, that's definitely one of them is like have a plan to get angry. Anger is not necessarily a bad emotion, but have a plan to be displeased. Have some emotional literacy because there's a difference between disappointed and I'm upset and I'm angry. And then do it with the right modality. And email is not it. So that would be the first example that comes to mind, especially from my military career side.
No, I love that. I think also we all know that there are individuals in the organizations that we work with that would prefer to get chewed out via email because it's simple for them to say, delete, right? I don't have to listen to that, right? Versus where an engaging conversation of you know, that's not the standard that we set. That's not the expectation that we have here as a group. You fell short of that. Telling someone that in a personal way, it allows them to absorb it and internalize it and recognize that they're part of the unit as opposed to separate and not of the unit. Tone gets lost in email, right?
Yeah, it sure does. And I think now we're on this subject. I know we're kind of drifting around in this, but I'm enjoying this part of it. In that area where we're talking about standards, right? So I do continuous improvement to set up a process anywhere material information might move, the tools of continuous improvement kind of apply. And so when I don't hit that standard and I'm giving that feedback or I'm in that conversation, I think the other two things that I've learned that I wish I'd learned a lot earlier were one, reserve a small amount of thought in your own mind, especially as a leader, that you are the one that could be the problem. Like we always say, like, oh, great leaders are humble. And what does it actually mean? It means that you can learn something from someone in any situation, but it also means that when I'm giving the feedback, when I'm holding the line, when I've had to make the tough call, when I'm giving that hard feedback, usually in my case anyway, there was something that I could have done or did not do that would have made the situation better. So in other words, what do you own as the leader in all of this issue? And then the second one was I put a lot of attention into this young airman, this young troop that we had, and a lot of time, a lot of attention. I can remember just things just didn't go well. And so it was time that I had to basically exit her from the military. There were some documentation needed to be had. Just basically, it would be the equivalent of you had to let someone go. You had to fire somebody. Okay. So I was having to do that after really being on a performance improvement plan, all the kind of good stuff. And I was venting to one of my colleagues who was also in the same squadron as I was. And he gave me some great advice. And he just said, you know, you can give up on this person as a member of the U.S. military. Insert your own organization name there, right? You can give up on this person as a member of your organization. You should never give up on someone as a human. And so it just changed how I reacted, how I spoke with her, how I dealt with her. And I think about that when it doesn't go right and it's not a good fit, are we treating people with dignity and respect on the way out as well? The end result's the same, but how am I treating someone with a little bit more respect than that?
Yeah, I remember early on my career as a young operations manager, the first time I ever had to separate someone from the organization, and it was an integrity issue. It was very black and white. There was no gray area around it. But then afterwards, when I went to go sit with my leader, the first question that came out of his mouth was, "How did you fail so and so as a leader?" And I think that what I got out of that is he conveyed to me that I was responsible for setting up the parameters for that person's success. And I created an environment where that person had to engage in deception to feel like they could be successful. And that was on me. That was not on him. Yeah, like I didn't detect it up front to be able to you know, deploy a countermeasure or to engage, ask the right question or to, I didn't go see, I just saw the results and I failed that person, as an individual. But, I think sometimes as leaders, we can get caught up in, oh, they didn't meet the standard, they're out. And like, as a leader, you're responsible for that person's success or failure.
Yeah. Look, if you're going to lead with consequences and rewards, well, just have some nicely worded stuff in HR and have a really good performance plan and compensation plan. But your work as a leader sits between those two things. Yeah, there are consequences when we have, and yes, there's you know, the rewards, the carrots and the sticks here, but that's your work as a leader is in between those two areas, right?
That's great feedback, Matt. My next question would be, there has to be a favorite moment in your career, like an aha moment where you just know you're doing the work that you're supposed to be doing and the place that you're doing it at with the people that you're doing it with. What's that aha moment for Matt?
My first response would be like, nope, don't know it. Don't have it. Don't got anything, Chris. Let's wrap this up.
Yeah. Thanks. Right. Yeah.
I don't know if this is the right answer. So we're just going to, I don't know. It's an interesting day today. We're all like working from home. If things change, habits are kind of moved all around in routine. So I'll just say the first thing that came to mind was really super recently. And this one's going to be more on the personal side for parenting. Right. So I was at my eldest son's graduation from his Montessori program that he goes to. He's entering into seventh grade. So we're there for his graduation in sixth grade. And my youngest son is sitting between my wife and I. We'll call him Henry because that's his name. Now, Henry has a lot of energy and Henry wants to go running around. But I, as the father, want to make sure that Henry knows we're all going to suffer together. So, Henry, you're going to sit here and we're all going to watch this long, long performance of graduation from sixth grade. Henry is super frustrated. Henry says, all I want to do is can I just go in the back and hang out with the teachers or the friends or whatever. Like, he wants to stand up and kind of move around and stuff. And I said, no, we're just going to sit here. It goes on for a while. I'm even kind of getting like, gosh, this has been for a while. Henry is like, he's so visibly upset now. He's literally almost in tears sitting there. He wants to leave so badly. My old eldest, we'll call him Ben because that's his name. He's watching this whole thing happen from the stage up there. Finally, Henry gets to be so restless and so worked up that it's almost like he won. He just wore me down. So he goes in the back. So now he's upset and now he's in the back, whatever. So later on, I'm sitting with my son back home with Ben. And Ben says something along the lines of, you know, you didn't do a really good job as a dad today. And I'm like, my first reaction would have usually been, look, let me tell you something, kid, like been around the sun a lot more times than you have. And then just lectured him into, this is what happens and you have to be disciplined. And I was telling Henry this, I could have just gone down all of that. But instead, using the kind of even the tools we were talking about, especially with the open-ended questions, I'm like, well, Ben, tell me more. And he said, well, obviously, you know, Henry was really upset and you didn't let him go do that. And I said, well, you know, Henry was upset because I think because of whatever, you know, he had to sit there. And I said, what do you think about all this? And he says, he's 12 now. And he says to me, Henry wasn't upset because you made him sit there. Henry was upset because you didn't trust him. And I was like, well, that you are absolutely correct. And you have proven that I'm not the best parent in this conversation. So asking the open-ended question allowed me to get feedback from my 12-year-old that gave me indications of like, he's 100% right. And so the way I mended the situation with Henry wasn't lecturing him about how he's got to sit there. It was having a conversation about how I was right. I didn't trust him. And then I went and apologized to Henry. And so when we're talking about like, am I doing the right work? I feel like if I can have that impact with someone in an organization, what I really want is for them to be able to take it with their direct reports, their span of care, but also take it into their personal life with whoever they interact with. And that's when I think, oh, am I doing the work correctly? And I could share anecdotes of that, but I'd much rather tell you about where I almost blew it as a parent, and a 12-year-old taught me a little bit about leadership.
I think what we take from that story is that in the Wyatt household, the acorn does become the oak eventually. And they, you know, you're doing something right when they're watching you, and that's their mode of behavior for how they felt like they could tell you that. That's good stuff.
It's fair. Yeah.
Great story. Well, Matt, do you have a leadership or continuous improvement pet peeve that you frequently see being applied or being done wrong?
Yeah, great question. I'm trying to think of a good example of this. I guess the good example I would see is when I'm using continuous improvement or lean, and then I back it up with a reduction of force. Like, great, we modernized this. Now I'm going to cut some people. I saw this being done at a couple of places in the Air Force, and I just saw what it had in our resulting civilian workforce. So that would be one, but that sounds like such a major one, and everyone goes, well, no, duh, don't do something like that. So I would bring it more in the simplistic terms of things that I see in the language and how we communicate things out. Like, why are we doing a process improvement? We don't ask on the end, like, how has this impacted your life? How did this remove frustrations for you? It seems like at times we stay in the quantitative analysis and we forget that I was doing this to make humans' lives better. And so the pet peeve would be, are we treating people with a little more dignity, a little more respect? And a lot of the times that comes in the communication around the continuous improvement tool sets.
Great observation. I think I know in my experience, sometimes you are operating at such a blistering pace that once you finish with something, you're thinking you need to move on to the next thing. And that moment of reflection of getting feedback and what went right, what went wrong, that after action kind of interaction sets you up for success for your next project, or it'll point out the areas that you need to improve at a very rapid pace in order to be successful.
Yeah. And even as you were saying this, there's one other one that I think is almost ingrained in our organizations. I don't know if it's my pet peeve. I just see it. And I think, do we understand what we say when we mean that? The phrase, we need to get this into the lowest levels of the organization. It has a really interesting etymology of how we even got there. Org charts are typically written with, you know, there's some person that's in charge, or the CEO, or the president, whatever it might be, they're at the top. And then I just cascade the org chart out. And then we call the people at the very bottom, right? This is where the lowest level of the organization. And typically, interestingly enough, if you looked at your org chart, and using that language, we looked at the lowest level of the organization, and they didn't show up for a day, the organization grinds to a halt. If the senior most person in that org chart doesn't show up for a day, it's pretty much perfectly fine, usually.
This is usual.
Yeah, right? This is usual. And so I think about, do we understand the language we're using and how it can be at times a little demeaning? Org charts are written the way they are, by the way. The very first plan for organization org chart was the Erie to Pennsylvania Railroad. It's written where the president and the board of directors is at the bottom. all the individual contributors are up higher. The reason our org charts look the way they do today was, look, World War I and World War II were fought. We organized our militaries that way, and leaders of the militaries, when they return home from those wars, how do we run our organizations? The same way. The difference is, in those time periods in the organization of World War I and II, there was a conscript military. We forced people in to serve. The people in your span of care in your organizations, they volunteer every day to come into it. But our organization, our hierarchy charts, still makes it look like it's still structured like this is how you run a company when people don't want to be here. Fascinating, right?
Yeah, you could take that a step further. Yeah, no, you could take it a step further and says that individual applied for the job that you posted and you chose them. So you chose them and to add them to your organization.
Yeah. So I just think the language about, I need to get it down to the lowest level. They're in my span of control as the leader versus, look, my job as a leader is to work for you. Make sure you have everything you need. It doesn't mean that I don't hold the line. I set strategic direction, all of those things that a leader has to do. But do I wake up thinking these are people that are in my span of care? And so that would be maybe a little bit more of a pet peeve to say, if you want to have a great culture, stop calling them lower life forms.
Yeah, I like span of care versus span of control. I'm gonna take that and I'm gonna use that from here on out. I will give you attribution, but that's where it's gonna go from here.
All good.
Matt, what do you consider the most important thing personally that you've learned in your career journey?
Oh, probably for me, it's probably the work that I love doing with organizations and with leaders as well. Have you listened at least long enough or asked enough questions to where you know that you're helping or solving the right problem? I wish I'd had that a lot earlier in my career, that my first response when someone said, hey, we've got this issue, it wasn't me. Well, great, let me apply my superior intellect, core drill into you to get some information and bequeath to you the beautiful answer. I wish I had learned earlier to say, well, what are your thoughts? What have you already tried? Tell me about where you are with this. Versus just jumping into solution mode. Einstein's quote, right? I had a problem and I had an hour to solve it. I'd spend 55 minutes really figuring out what the problem is and 5 minutes in the solution. I think earlier on in my career, I was just the exact opposite. Like it was, you know, shoot the name kind of thing. So I wish I had taken that and learned that. It's probably the most powerful work that I do. And then I love to see other leaders doing that and how fast someone can bring up on their problem solving skills and time leaders get back by not going after and solving problems that, frankly, they shouldn't be solving.
Good advice. What piece of advice would you give to someone who's just starting out with leadership or continuous improvement?
When you start in a new place, in a new organization, a new team, or a new department, ask the people, what's the hardest or worst or most frustrating or the job that people don't want to do, and then go do that job for a week, for a day, I don't care, for a month, just go do it. You will learn a whole lot. You'll gain a lot of empathy. You'll gain a lot of credibility. Go do the job that no one wants to do. And I don't care what level you are, even if you're the CEO walking in, right? They have this show called, what is it, Undercover Boss, where you have to dress up like somebody else to go do crap work in your own organization. Like you don't have to dress up on somebody. You don't have to have a show do it. Just go do that. So that would be my advice for someone starting out, whether you're a brand new leader or otherwise, it would be that. Because when you do that as well, you get to know what the front line is experiencing. And that's where you really want to have some more empathy for.
You know, that reminds me of a moment in my career where I was working for a very large logistics company. And it was at the peak season right there where you're trying to make the rush for everybody to get their Christmas gifts in an e-commerce setting. And a piece of equipment went down that was the diverter that made the items, the boxes go to the truck. And so there are all these boxes piling up. Yeah. And our chief operating officer was there with us at night. And he comes and grabs me. He goes, I need somebody I can count on. Come with me. Let's go to the back and help these guys out. They're jammed. So here it is, me sitting on the dock loading trucks with the chief operating officer of the company. And those guys that work back there all the time, they still talk about that story about the day that the COO went back there. He's like, man, that guy, I thought he was just a suit, but he can hustle the boxes, right? I mean, I'll work with him any day, right? One of them said, man, I'd rather work with him than work with you. Like they were driving each other back. But I think that goes back to what you're saying about where you sit on the org chart too. Like, be humble enough to do the work, like be humble enough to help the mission.
Yeah. And people love this when it happens. And I'm not saying you have to do this all of the time. I'm just saying, like, okay, well, if I'm new to an organization and when people need help, I like cars. So I was recently watching this car race and something had happened on the track. It doesn't matter what it is, but something had happened on the track. And so the crew comes out to kind of fix what happened on the track. And the president of it was an interior course of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And the president of the Speedway gets a broom out of one of the trucks and starts sweeping. Now the announcer announces, ladies and gentlemen, president so-and-so, and he's sweeping with a broom. And the entire crowd starts cheering that are there at the thing. Why? Because good, you should be picking up a broom. Let's get this thing fixed. They love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Conversely, what piece of advice would you give to someone who's a little bit further along in their career? I know not everyone can go to their 12-year-old for, you know, advice on how to become a parent, but right. Maybe from a professional standpoint, something that someone told you recently that helped you out.
You know, I'll tell a story rather than the advice, because I found it was so interesting to me. And he's actually having a birthday coming up, and so I thought it was interesting. And I know I'm going to say the company's name, and then everyone's going to be like, "Well, I hate them," or someone's going to say, "Oh, I love them." It's an airline, and so I think you're in trouble no matter what you do. But this happens to be the president of American Airlines. His name is Doug Parker, and we do some work with them and his leadership team. And I thought what was interesting to me was, he had achieved a lot of things. He emerged into the world's largest airline, so US Air and American. And my father, crazy enough, used to be an airline pilot for Air California, which was purchased by American back in like 1986. So he flew his career for American. So the fact that I'm now working with them, I thought was really interesting. And while they're working through all of their systems and trying to be a better and better airline, at one point, Doug Parker just said, "Well, I'm gonna go to something meaningful with my life. I've created this financial structure. We brought the airlines together." He was going to go be like a school teacher, which is perfectly fine. But I don't think he looked at it that I can have an impact as a school teacher, but if I want to have an impact in people's lives, man, I'm the CEO of the world's largest airline. I have 130,000 souls that are in my span of care. Like, that's how I'm going to have an impact. And it was interesting to me that I think he was just going through the motions through a career and gotten to a level and then realized, man, all I've done is increase my ability to positively impact people's lives. You have people in your span of care for X amount of hours, but it's the majority of their waking hours. I can have an impact in just that way. So that's the one I would say for a senior leader. Do you recognize that you have that potential? What you do with it is up to you, but do you at least in the beginning recognize that's in your wheelhouse to do something with?
Great story. I think a lot of folks can pause and reflect on that and probably discover that they have a lot more power to influence people positively than they think they do. So I'm glad you shared that with us. Do you have a favorite book, author, or something that you would recommend to our listeners?
I do. And I appreciate you asking this. And just in transparency, before this podcast began, Chris was so nice and he said, "Hey, do you have this? I'm going to ask you about a book." And I said, "Oh, I could plug Everybody Matters," which is a story about Barry Waymiller. And then I could say something nice like all proceeds go to charity, which is the truth. But actually, I want to plug a book that's coming out. It's called Leading from the Jump Seat. The author is Peter Docker. I'll send you a link after, and I think, Chris, you'll put it in the show notes. But Peter was a former Royal Air Force pilot, flew the Queen of England around, just a guy that I've done some work with. He's an independent, and so he's writing this book now. He's also the co-author of Find Your Why. It was the companion to Simon Sinek's Start With Why book. And so he's worked with them. And so he and I have done a lot of work together. He's just a great thinker on leadership, leading from the jump seat. For those of you not familiar, so there's a pilot, there's usually a co-pilot in a cargo aircraft. Well, the jump seat sits between them. And the interesting thing about the jump seat is you've trained the other pilots. Often the instructor sits there, but obviously the jump seat has no controls. So think about teaching one of your children to drive a car and you're in the passenger seat. Leaning from the jump seat means I'm building other great people. And so I like the analogy. I like the metaphor. I really like him. He's got an English accent. So what's not to like? You'll love the book. We'll put it in the show notes. It's coming out in a couple of weeks here. So we'll have the date for you.
All right. We usually have a small little buffer between when we record these and when we release these. So perhaps the stars will align for Leading from the Jump Seat.
There you go.
That we can help out with giving some promotion to the book. Matt, you and I both know that magic wands don't exist, but if they did and you could use that to fix anything with an organization or group that you're working with, what would you typically wave your magic wand at first?
Onboarding.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I want you to think about your own organization. Typically, the very first piece of documentation, whether it's electronic or not, that an individual who just joined your organization gets, it usually is something to do with legal, compliance, IT. It usually has something to do with what our organization about, what's our purpose, why did we choose you, how thankful we are that you're here, what are our values. It's usually something that's more compliance driven. And so when I think about a 90-day period of an onboarding, sets the tone for how I think about that organization, how I might think about my future in that organization. There are some really easy things to do in onboarding. That's the one thing I go after with a magic wand, because it's easy to do. It's not really hard. You can use the tools of continuous improvement to help, because I usually have all these shared services that are coming in, whether it's IT or finance or pay or HR or compliance, safety, all these areas. And so to the individual, I can sometimes feel like these are all different companies. Like I'm getting hit at by this. And even for those entities, it can be challenging. HR will say something like, well, I need to get you my benefits package. And then IT says, well, I don't have an email set up for them yet because I don't have their name. So onboarding is where I set the right tone for someone. I can use continuous improvement to make it easier on my employees, the people in my span of care, as well as somebody that I just hired. So that's where I would, a little soapbox there, but that's what I go after, is onboarding.
No, I love that, because onboarding begins the moment you choose to bring that person to the organization, not on their start date. Like there's the upfront work that needs to be done, so that how do you engineer and design a positive first day experience for that individual, and a positive first week experience, and a positive first 30 and 60 and 90 days. And who's their wingman? Like who do they go to that's a peer in their organization, as opposed to just, hey, welcome here. You report to Bill. Bathroom's down the way. We get coffee here. Oh, you got to be in this next meeting at 9 p.m. or 9 a.m. Oh, by the way, you're presenting, right? I mean, you can create you have control over the experience you create for your employees.
Yeah, and I'd even offer. Because it goes
by span of care.
Yeah, and for some organizations, for depending on what the hire is, that onboarding process probably starts in the interview process, how they go through, how they experience just the culture of being interviewed. And even if it's, we're going to say no to you, how is that experience? I'd look at all of that aspect. And then if I'm doing a lot of hiring in a larger organizations, I'm even putting people together as cohorts. Like you're all kind of new here. You're going to learn a lot of institutional knowledge that we haven't been able to capture. And so I want you sharing what your lessons learned are with each other too.
That's great stuff. Matt, I appreciate you being a guest on the podcast today and sharing your experiences with us. How can people connect with you if they want to learn more about what you do, or if they have a question for you based on something they heard today?
No, I appreciate it. Our website is www.ccoleadership.com/resources. Nothing to sell you there, just a bunch of stuff, podcasts just like you have, templates, communication, all kinds of stuff. It's all free. Go ahead and grab it, rip it off, put your own name on it. We're all happy to share all that kind of stuff. If you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, my last name is spelled W-H-I-A-T. There's a huge family story there that will remain unsaid for now. It doesn't include monkeys, but it's W-H-I-A-T. My first name is Matt. Only my mom calls me Matthew, and only when I'm in trouble. So connect with me on LinkedIn. I would enjoy staying connected with you. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast today.
No, Matt, I appreciate that. And I'm the same. I'm a Christopher to my mother, and only my mother. To everyone else, I'm Chris. Thanks. So let nicknames of the world unite.
All right.
I appreciate your time, and thanks for being such a great guest.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I want to thank Matt for being a guest on the podcast today. I know I got a lot out of our conversation, and I hope that you did as well. Be sure to go to the show notes page at leanleadershippodcast.com. Check out the links and how to connect with Matt if you have any questions about what we talked about today. As always, I welcome your feedback on how to improve the podcast. If you like the podcast, make sure to subscribe and leave a rating on the podcast on whatever channel or platform that you listen to us on. Thank you for listening, and until next time, seek progress over perfection.
Thanks for listening to the Lean Leadership Podcast with Chris Burnham. Get more info, resources, tools, or connect at leanleadershippodcast.com.